What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off.
Dmitry Tokarev is the CEO at Copper. In this conversation, we discuss the buy-side problems with legacy markets, what financial infrastructure actually entails, how custody and prime brokerage in crypto is evolving, and why LPs drive decision-making in investing. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you do as well.
Are you curious about cryptocurrency and you don't know where to begin? I've got a great way for you to try. You can use StormPlay, a free and fun way to start earning in exchange for your time. That's right, you don't necessarily have to make a financial investment to begin. You can simply download, register, and then discover these micro tasks that they present you that meet your interest, and then you're rewarded with these Storm Bolts. The bolts are then converted and can be withdrawn into your favorite cryptocurrency, including the Storm Token, Ethereum, or my favorite, Bitcoin. If you go and download the StormPlay app today, you can earn cryptocurrency rewards by playing new games and trying out cool new products. It's worth a try, and it's a great way to get started. Remember, go check out StormPlay in the App Store today.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, bang, bang. I am here with Dmitry coming to us live from New York City. Not actually live, but it sounds cool to say that, so I'm going to keep using that. Thank you so much for coming and doing this.
Thank you for having me. Very excited to be here.
For sure. So let's start with your background. You're not American, and no. You've got a very unique perspective on financial infrastructure, but give us kind of the overview of how do you end up in the seat today?
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up in Siberia, and as everyone in Siberia, you study either computer science or math. So
where is Siberia for the geography?
It's a city called Krasnoyarsk. It's like 5-hour flight from Moscow. It's actually closer to Beijing. It's like 3-hour flight to Beijing.
But it's in Russia, right?
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Okay. So, got it. It's cold there.
Very. Yeah. -40 Celsius.
-40 Celsius.
-40 Fahrenheit.
Negative Fahrenheit all year round.
No. It's like eight months, but like it ranges.
How hot does it get?
It gets pretty. It's a similar climate to Canada, actually. So it's sharp continental climate.
Got it. So like in the summertime, we're talking
Plus 30 degrees. So, you know, that's like, you know, 80, 90 degrees Fahrenheit.
Oh, wow. You guys are real volatile there. Okay.
So it's a high volatility.
All right. Maybe I'll come in the summer. I've always wanted to come in the summer when everyone wears the white jackets. They blend in with the 12 feet of snow. Perfect. All right. So you grew up in Siberia.
So I grew up in Siberia kind of.
everyone does math.
halfway through high school, some people thought I'm smart to go to university. So I left school a bit earlier and started computer science. And as one of my projects, I actually built a trading game, which was kind of like a sinusoid where you press basically up and down buttons. And that way you basically make profit. It's like lasts for 1 minute. But you get the result in the end. And actually, that's how I got interested in trading. So I left uni there to go to the UK and study there, like study finance and to basically get educated in trading and to become a quant. And fast forward, 6 years, I was a quant in a hedge fund, basically long short natural resources, building all the different strategies for traditional markets with the guys from ex-Goldman team who taught me basically everything. I the fundamental knowledge that I have today, I got from them, which I'm very grateful for. And then I decided to move, and a decision was made to move into financial technologies, and I partnered up with two guys who were studying asset management company to build an asset manager in the UK with technology angle. So we grew that to over 100 people, over a couple of billion assets under management. And I think they've added another billion since I left. Hope those events are not correlated. But the at the same time, we had quite large client base from Asia who got very interested in 2017 in crypto space. And we started building a product for them, which eventually we didn't launch for the lack of institutional infrastructure. And that's how I switched into crypto.
All right. So hold on. You just covered a lot there. Trading natural resources. What do you mean by that?
It's basically quant strategies. So mean reverting strategies, momentum strategies, statistical arbitrage. There are a few funds actually currently, maybe like a couple proper ones, doing statistical arbitrage in crypto space. So basically you milk statistical inefficiencies in the market. So you have, well, for example, a very standard one is GLDGDX. You know, it's like a gold ETF versus gold ETF. You know, so they have to kind of like go in the same direction together. And when there was a discrepancy in returns, like, you know, that's what you basically go long one, short the other, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. So examples like this, or one of the popular algorithms that I really liked, I mean, currently it's probably would have been called AI, but back then it was just called Kalman filter, is something, whereas, you know, you used in automobiles industry for self-driving cars a lot. It's basically, you know, your wheels have velocity and they move somewhere and then you have a GPS signal. As a matter of fact, like those two signals are incorrect. So you have something called Kalman gain, that basically a coefficient that always educates itself with historical data and then puts the correct coordinates for your car. So that could be applied.
Because the GPS is inaccurate and then the speed of the wheel and the direction of the wheel is inaccurate.
Yeah.
But if you put those two together along with additional software, then you can get a much
More
accurate pinpointed position.
Yeah. So that could be applied to stocks. That could be applied, for example, to Bitcoin prices. That could be applied to, you know, all sorts of things. So it's basically like, you know, statistical arbitrage. Mm-hmm. So
smart people stuff.
I mean, some would say, I mean, especially not the
dumb people would call it smart people stuff.
I mean, I wouldn't call it. I think everyone's, you know, have their own kind of like angles and of understanding different parts, right? So,
got it. Okay. And so let's talk a little bit. You mentioned AI as like today it would be called AI.
Yeah.
Back then it wouldn't be. It feels like that term has just become like a coverall, right? In terms of, oh, it's like some software that does something that isn't 1 + 1 = 2.
Yeah.
Like AI, it's artificial intelligence, right? Like, how far do you think we actually are with true AI? Like, it doesn't feel like we're really that far in progress compared to how popular the terminology is.
Yeah. From that standpoint, obviously we're not in AI business, so for me it will be hard to sort of say how far we are in actually.
Well, around trading, trading specifically.
But for example, why it is like that? I mean, if you look in the last, for example, 4 years, and this is actually a fundamental problem which links to why it's very hard to build something in a large financial organization, because every time something new comes out, you sprinkle that on top of your next software project, mm-hmm. and you call it, you know, in 2015 it was big data. In, you know, then it was VR, AR, then it was blockchain, this year it's AI, next year it'll be something else. But the residual effect of that technology, we're also yet to see. So the traditional kind of cycle of technology to market, I would say maybe about 4 years. So we're just seeing like big data products being pushed to the market and people actually buying those, mm-hmm. utilizing those to basically generate revenue, so create like improve operational efficiencies in their businesses, et cetera. So I think, you know, extrapolating that, I would say, yeah, so if AI is a thing of 2018, we're probably about 3 years away from seeing something actually having reasonable impact on how the markets become more efficient or creating value to the customers.
Got it. So before we dig into the bulk of what I want to talk about, I want to start with financial infrastructure,
right?
Because we're going to talk a lot about what the problems are, what the potential solutions are, what you guys are doing, et cetera. What do you mean when you use the terminology financial infrastructure? Like at a high level, what does that entail?
Yeah. I mean, to understand financial infrastructure, it's also important to understand the institutional kind of landscape, because people talk about institutions. It's actually not like, you know, one particular profile that we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, insurance funds, we're talking about pension funds, hedge funds, mutual funds, UCITS funds, all sorts of other asset managers, and all high nets, ultra high nets, family offices, you know, so all of them have different problems and different kind of requirements for the infrastructure in order for them to conduct business activities. When it comes particularly to hedge funds, it's there is nothing new that's happening today in hedge fund sector which we haven't seen. It's the same movie that we saw 20, 30 years ago, where, you know, smart guys from Ivy League schools would come out and start managing family money, for example. And then institutional guy would come in and say, look, I'm going to give you like 10 million ticket or 20 million ticket, but you have to basically no self-custody, no self-administration, you got to use a prime broker, and all the different requirements. And this is exactly what's happening, basically.
And that is... those requirements were part of risk management?
It's from there. I mean, self-administration went kind of like out of the window since Madoff. Like no one just takes it. Like,
let's go through each one of those, because I think, again, many of the people listening sort of understand the finance world.
Yeah.
Really excited about the crypto world. When you say self-administration, what is that?
Self-administration is basically you verify your own net asset value, right? So you say like I gave you $10 million to manage, and you say like, this month I have $10.5 million, Dimitri, and I trust you basically. And you can, for example, if you invest in ICO on pre-sale, how would you value that ICO? At the pre-sale price, was the reasonable market price for that to be valued? So you have players such as administrators that would basically come with the correct valuation, and then they would report NAV to the investors, to the LPs, limited partners. Basically, the playbook of a hedge fund is you need to have prospectus, which basically outlines what kind of activities can you conduct, what can you invest in, what you can't invest in, what are the terms, what are, you know, things like, you know, watermark, gates, all of that, basically. Then you would need to have administrator, which we covered. You need to have a custody and or a prime broker, basically, sometimes mainly, like, you know, in the hedge fund space, you know, prime broker would act as custodian for your assets as well. So then from the software side of things, you need to have a PMS, which is a portfolio management system, which does the position aggregation for you and calculates like different returns, for example, in the positions. You need to have OMS system, which is an order execution management system, which then is responsible for executing this your trades in different venues. And then depending upon your strategy, you would probably have data provider, which is in traditional space is Bloomberg, for example, in crypto space, different. And then probably a research. So there you have it. So this is basically how you build a hedge fund. Mm-hmm. Without without the first, let's say, four, it's very, very hard to come to your LPs and say, you have to invest in this. Or it's very hard to get anywhere with a ticket above $1 million, you know, because there will be asking exactly the same questions they're asking you today in a traditional space. And in traditional space, it's very easy because you say, like, look, I don't control the funds, administrator controls the funds, then my prime broker executes on these venues and I generate you alpha. Alpha is the return above the market. Mm-hmm. So, and they're happy with that. In crypto space, for example, let's go, for example, with custody. Custody in crypto space has been traditionally associated with purely security. But on top of the security, there is also a business application of a custodian that needs to be there. And that's, that business application is so you make sure that the funds cannot be misappropriated by the fund manager. Mm-hmm. Now, if
meaning something like, hey, you have a fund, 70% is supposed to be deployed in X strategy, 30% is supposed to be deployed in Y strategy. Yeah. If I, as the fund manager, can just do whatever I want, you as the LP have no confidence or confirmation that I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, that's one thing. Administrator would look after that. But the other thing is also, if you basically deploy from a custody to, for example, an exchange in crypto, you can just take the funds from there to your personal wallet. Mm-hmm. Nothing stops you from doing that. Mm-hmm. So that renders custodian obsolete in the equation. Mm-hmm. Because why would you need a custodian if you can just, you know, basically you're in self-custody mode, a step away. Mm-hmm. So that's the problem that LPs, you know, they're aware of that, and there's a lot based on trust, you know. So this is the problem that we've been solving with a client of ours who brought this problem to us. And it's the company called Nickel Asset Management. They've got 25 years of experience in investments, right? So they've seen all sorts of market cycles, types of LPs and everything.
They've seen good people, bad people, and everything in between.
Exactly. And say, like, look, if this is not there, we're just not going to launch it. And, you know, we build it, and it turned out that, you know, this is something which is quintessential in this space, especially for two other types of players, market makers and funds of funds. Because as a fund of funds, you deploy capital to several funds. It only takes one fund to take your crypto. So, for example, you see a very kind of interesting asset manager generating, like, you know, 600% return a month, and you're like, wow, I'm going to give him $50,000, for example. Imagine if he takes it from, you know, Bittrex or whatever, any other exchange, for example, and disappears. Your entire operation is basically non-existent anymore because you just violated your prospectuses, you know, conditions that you would have put in there that, you know, this is not going to happen. So, and for market makers, it's very, very important thing. And as this industry grows larger and larger, when you have assets deployed across 25 different exchanges and you have a problem such as, generally, you have market makers done automatically, right? So you fill the order book with limit orders, spread it across different exchanges. And when liquidity dries up in one place and it aggregates in another place, you have to do the reallocation. The way it happens in 90% of places today is there is a senior executive who pick up the phone call and say, could you move the funds? Now, that senior executive, in theory, has access to like 50 to 100 million of borderline untraceable asset. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if somebody approaches him and asks politely to transfer it elsewhere, you know, that is a risk, physical threat. Mm-hmm. So that as this industry grows larger in size, that needs to be eliminated. Withdrawal processes would have to be covered within like the same kind of predefined ecosystem where it can move and nowhere else. Mm-hmm. So this is the important part.
Because what you're basically talking about is not just rogue actors, but you're mm-hmm. talking about people who are malicious. You are talking about people who are threatened. You are talking about people who could actually just make mistakes. Yep. They might even be trying to do something incorrectly. Yeah. They type in the wrong wallet address.
Right? Absolutely.
It's not just the bad actors. Yeah. It is also other issues that can come up. And so by having what I would consider a more mature kind of professional financial infrastructure, it solves a lot of these problems.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's also like, when coming back like generally to the question, like what would LPs be comfortable with, right? Like, for example, you know, we know the manager and they're good guys and everything, and we'd be happy to give them 1 million allocation. But before we're going to see like, you know, serious tickets coming into this, the argument like, you know, they're good guys, it only goes like as far as certain ticket size. Mm-hmm. Then you just need to have a robust framework, which mm-hmm. you know for a fact nothing goes anywhere, mm-hmm. and you just like leave the manager to generate your returns.
And from what I've seen, and it sounds like you as well, many LPs, when they approach these crypto asset managers, mm-hmm. they just have an expectation of things like there's no self-custody, mm-hmm. right? And there's no self-administration, et cetera. Yeah. And that is being solved and addressed in the traditional world. Mm-hmm. So there's an expectation of if you're an asset manager, you follow certain criteria and have certain structures.
Yeah.
When you look on the crypto side, all of that's gone out the window historically. Yeah. And so when you see it all go out the window, what ends up happening is the LPs are faced with the decision. Mm-hmm. Either they're good guys, I trust them, mm-hmm. type situation, mm-hmm. right? So like, hey, I like this team, I think that they can do a good job, I'm willing to take the risk, and I'm just gonna give them the money and I don't care.
Yeah.
Or what I think we're seeing now, and I think this is where you guys are coming into play, is you're getting professional LPs who say, I want exposure to the asset class, I don't care if you're a good person or mm-hmm. not, I can't just blindly trust you.
Yeah.
And so I am going to pull you as an asset manager into having professional, mature financial infrastructure, yep. right? So like, I'm basically gonna dangle money out there yep. as a carrot to get you to become infrastructure-wise what I need you to become, so then I can give you the money. Yep.
And keep in mind, it was also like, some of them have minimum ticket sizes. So some of them are not gonna give you a million. I mean, say like, okay, I can give you a million, but like we have a minimum ticket size is 10 million, for example. And with 10 million, like those are the conditions that you need to go through. Mm-hmm. So some
just
of them—
the due diligence process.
Yeah, and like they can't be bothered with investing, like if we're talking about like large tickets, like 10 million is like, you know, like we've seen quite a lot. Like, you know, we can only come in with 10 million plus because otherwise it's not worth our attention. So and I think fund of funds as they're entering into the sector, and there are a few very, very like smart players that are just, you know, launching. I think it will be quite big because fund of funds attract larger ticket sizes. They do have, they basically take care of the entire due diligence process that we discussed. They go through like everything to make sure that everything is as robust as possible. That's why they're charging fees on top of as well. So mm-hmm. those type of players will be very, very impactful.
Got it. So describe to us, kind of two more pieces of the problems with the financial infrastructure, mm-hmm. and then we'll get into what you're building. The first is the traditional banking system.
Mm-hmm.
Horrendous.
Yeah, I mean, this is very, I mean, like kind of in mathematical expectation, this is the fundamental reason why we're in this business, because it's something which people don't see and people should know. And let me describe you the following scenario. So you would have an asset manager and then another asset manager, and they've conducted a trade. Say they bought Apple shares. I mean, that settles T+3. So then the mechanics of that, what's actually happening in the background, like these guys have database, these guys have database. Both of them will have sub-custodians, right? They'll have like bank A as custodian for that asset manager, and then bank B as a custodian for that asset manager. So then actually trade needs to, the shares need to go basically from that custodian to that custodian. So the way it normally happens, it happens through Swift. Everyone uses Swift. So keep in mind four databases already in this equation. So all of these databases have, you know, software integrators and people who maintain it and all kinds of like soft that needs to work together. And majority of those parts of the infrastructure has been built in 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, so it's very, very old. So trade happens, and God forbid somebody misses a comma in MT500 message on the Swift. There you have it, trade stuck in limbo, not settled. Now, why is this important? Because a person at this asset manager, at this asset manager, at this bank, and at this bank spend half of the week figuring out how to settle the trade. Now, extrapolating into the entire sector, we're talking about 90% of costs of any financial institution is salaries, right? Like our salaries and like, you know, all the expenses associated with human resources. So out of that, probably the most efficient places would have 40% doing that, basically. So those are the most efficient places. Now, traditionally, I always give an example of a small Swiss bank, a billion, for example, assets under management / custody. They would have 25 people. Guess how many people would be doing this ops?
Out of 25 people, yeah. 18.
Like roughly 18 people would do operations, and then you have like two kind of like mid-level, and then you have the rest of sales, basically. Wow. So Swiss salaries are not cheap. And why is this important is that, like, it's not the banks that are going to save money. It's like it's pushed to consumers, right? Like it's pushed to us. Like we pay for that. We pay all of this infrastructure cost. So we're talking about like slashing everything in half, basically, by implementing something like this correctly.
Huge.
Yeah. So, and the database maintenance and infrastructure maintenance, we're talking about, for example, tier two, tier three banks' budget for IT infrastructure is roughly around $3 billion a year.
Wow.
So imagine what kind of like IT infrastructure budgets like big players are having. Like this is not a big player. This is like tier two, tier three bank, right? Like we're talking about like billions, billions and billions and billions and billions, right? So, and all of that can basically go away if you have a single source or golden source of truth. And that's why blockchain is important for financial infrastructure. Like that, there you have a situation whereas you no longer need to sync up databases amongst each other. You sync it up with the golden source. So that reduces cost dramatically. It allows you to be more competitive. And more importantly, it allows new players to enter into the field. Because, for example, my when I started my career, to launch a hedge fund, it would cost, basically, the math would work out in such a manner that you need to have $100 million assets, basically, under management in order to basically pay for, you know, like lights and salaries and things like that. So in September last year, when we announced our products, we were at HFM CEO Summit. The number that people discussed was 385 million. Now, how many fund managers do you know that can just leave BlackRock, Blackstone, and start a fund with $500 million?
Not very many.
It's very difficult. It's very, very difficult launching a fund. So we're talking about if those infrastructure costs are being reduced, then we have a much like fairer environment for starting a competitive environment as well. Regulations have to do a lot with that as well, because new introduction of regulations like been affecting those quite significantly. For example, in Europe, you had MiFID II, basically, which basically fell on last year. MiFID II, for example, requires you to submit 80 plus fields after each trade to the regulator.
Really?
Yeah. So all of this.
What the heck is in all that information?
Yeah, like, you know, who you trade. Like before it was four. Before MiFID II, MiFID I, basically. It was four.
With the four is what? Who you traded with, when?
Yeah, kind of like asset. Basic information, what assets, et cetera, et cetera. Now it's like everything, absolutely everything.
How many breaths did you take? What was your heartbeat? Where were you sitting? Right? Did you go to the bathroom beforehand or not?
Exactly. Yeah, the thing is, like, you end up paying more software integrators that would basically implement that for you and make sure that it all communicates.
It just increases cost, it increases friction.
Exactly. Yep, and from the regulator standpoint, it's blockchain, it's blessing in disguise. It's something which can solve so many problems, but it's one of the situations where I don't think that they will just come out and say, guys, hey, we've built this, you know, and this is how you use it, this is the GitHub. Like, you know, let's go bug bounty, like all of that. Like, this is not how it's going to happen. You need to show them how this could be used. You need to build the tools and show them, like, look, guys, actually, for the first time in history, you could be at the forefront of, you know, preventing money laundering, terrorist financing, and things like that. Because blockchain is actually not a very, very good, system to be, you know, money laundering. Like it can be traced all the way back. Mm-hmm. And if you and in traditional space, you know, once you have it in a bank from cash to, that's it. Like you only know like the last point of entry. So for regulators, I think and I hope it's not going to be a quick process. We're talking about like years. Maybe like five, hopefully no longer than that, but potentially it could be even 10, where regulators are able to extrapolate like information that's happening and even be like, you know, preventing and seeing those trades happen in real life, mm-hmm. flagging those, which will remove the costs from the players and you know, create less frictionless and more competitive environment, which benefits everyone, all market participants.
I love it. And then there's this bridge between the engineers yeah. and financial firms yeah. and the finance people,
yeah.
right? They usually have very different backgrounds.
Yeah.
They have very different perspectives.
Yeah.
They spend their time doing different things. They almost speak different languages, right? I always joke and say one speaks the language of like GitHub and the other speaks the language of Excel.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, right? Yeah.
And so they just, they're working on, in the same company, they're yeah. working on the same problem, just very different ways.
Yeah.
How big of a problem is that, and how big of a gap is there between those two groups?
Huge, huge. To give it to quantifiable numbers, like in 2015, everyone got excited about fintech. Remember, like big data, fintech is going to change the world and everything. And then a bunch of banks and large institutions started like projects, like pilot projects, or some of like not pilot, like full scope projects.
Mm-hmm.
And 90% of those projects failed. They failed because of that reason, because of lack of understanding between those two tribes. And we're talking about like top 10, top five largest banks in the UK. They had a project that they spent $500 million on, so mm-hmm. 500 million. And they didn't launch it because they couldn't migrate the database.
Really?
Yeah. So database migration basically is a significant portion of failed launches. Because the project is built, but then it comes to migrating, and the migration takes such a long time that the project kind of like dies halfway through. And we're talking about like in banks and large institutions, they'll realize that problem. Like for example, one of the top 10 largest banks in the world, for example, today uses a syntax called COBOL in their core banking system. So they lost documentation to what the core banking engine does. Roughly in like early 2000s or like mid 2000s, and had to write a PHP wrapper around to understand what the core banking basically system does. Mm-hmm. And COBOL been used widely in financial services, and this is syntax developed by American military in the 70s. And people who know COBOL either retired or dead, and lots of guys basically coming out of retirement because the money that people pay to patch now those systems are ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And we're actually seeing a few engineers that start to learn COBOL because, you know, we're talking about like Java consultant with getting paid like the rate is about £800 to $1,000 a day. And COBOL is $3,000 a day. So you can get paid $3,000 a day to patch the system written in COBOL. So within the final, like the reason why it still exists is because it's such a massive machine that needs to migrate from one to another, and then engineers can build it, the migration needs to be performed kind of like with joint efforts, and it always happens because it's not uncommon to have like 2, 3, 4, 5 years integration cycles of the software in large institutions. Mm-hmm. Doing complete from the ground up, like rejiggling of the entire systems, is borderline impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why also from where we're going with the whole financial infrastructure based on blockchain, I believe that we're not gonna see large institution coming in and saying like, look, we built everything, thanks very much.
Mm-hmm.
It's either going to be through acquisition or it's going to be completely new from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And keep in mind the budgets of the IT infrastructure. These guys can afford to basically drop $1 billion on a company that built something.
Yeah, just no problem.
Like this.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're talking about like traditional space, for example, from the investing standpoint, you have like VCs that need to sell to Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Google, et cetera, et cetera. How many financial institutions can buy a startup in this sector, like huge number, and they're all
almost all of them.
All of them, exactly. So it's going to be pretty exciting to see how this will unwrap and how this is going to be integrated. But the future of financial services is most certainly will be based on blockchain.
What are you guys doing
When it comes to infrastructure?
Yeah.
So custody is the first point. Basically, we rebuild.
Name the company. who you started it with, and then what you guys are doing.
So we're called Copper. So we started the company because we couldn't find suitable institutional infrastructure service providers in crypto space when we structured the fund. And we did structure a fund, basically we went prospectus, administrator, you know, everything's done. Started to look out for custodians, found wallets who then didn't realize they're custodians, and they said, well, then they basically changed their branding to custodians. But then I was trying to explain to the guys, like, look, I can't pay you withdrawal fees. I'm charging $330 like management performance fee, which is already like, you know, should be illegal, like, because, but the clients are happy to pay for it because the asset's going like, you know, 100% every 2 months or so. So, but I can't pay you withdrawal fees. That's insane. So anyway, long story short, we didn't launch the fund. We shut it down because we couldn't find infrastructure. The decision was made that it's an opportunity, right? So inefficiency equals opportunity. So we started building custody for buy side players like we like spend our careers being. So we built custody product. We built it a little bit different. We didn't build it in such a manner as like, you know, this is crypto, that's where it's stored.
Yep.
Crypto on our custody platform is stored basically because it's not like a gold bar. You don't need a mountain to store it. Like it's stored using cryptography, so in mathematical expectations. So you don't have to have somewhere stored at all points in time because it creates unnecessary vulnerability. And then we threw it off basically completely offline, no connection with online layer, and just sits there. When you need to sign a transaction, we use basically optical error gapping. So generated QR codes to pass the information between devices. So then we started developing this and we built a framework called Walled Garden, which solves that problem of having predefined ecosystem of execution venues where a manager can transfer the crypto and nowhere else. And which gives a massive comfort to LPs. Basically say, we don't have access to anything. You know, Copper is handling, Copper doesn't have access to anything, no one has access to anything, but it works. And the Walled Garden framework basically went live earlier this year, like in January. And then we also looked into OTC market and we started looking at everything is kind of like settled bilaterally. And you know, whereas it's all exciting to have like smart contracts settling the trades and everything, it doesn't exist yet. And today, it's not uncommon to see a trade being settled in 2 weeks. So, I mean, this is crazy. I mean, we're talking about T+3, T+2 inefficiencies, and we're talking about, like, you know, within the crypto community, people discussing, like, how to scale the, you know, to process, you know, the blocks instead of, like, you know, 20 minutes in 2 seconds. But trades are settled, like, in 2 weeks. So that's crazy. So we built a settlement framework and clearing framework for institutional players so they can settle, basically, through us. And the development of all of that is basically it's exactly what people are used to in traditional space. For example, prime broker and prime brokerage service is going to be super important in the space because people can utilize the tool provided by prime brokers to use their capital that's been given to them by LPs more efficiently, i.e. generate more return, i.e. more money coming into the space. So it all kind of makes sense. And we're talking about margin funding, lending, borrowing, repos, reverse repos, collateral rehypothecation. So all of these terms, I mean, I know that they might be confusing for some of the audience, but those are basically the tools where, you know, for example, you can borrow with a promise to buy it back at a certain price later at a certain date. It allows you to create different strategies, different hedging strategies where, you know, if you're winning on one leg, you're not going to lose on another leg, and, you know, things like that. Or collateral rehypothecation is, for example, whereas, you know, you store your funds with the prime broker and then those funds are being lent to someone else, you're getting a cut off those fees that they charge basically a borrower on the other side. So all of these parts of infrastructure are super important. And it's still early days. I mean, it's institutional space is ridiculously small. We have a lot of interests, kind of like, you know, and obviously you guys on your side speak with big institutions, but you know how careful they are, how, like, you know, takes 6 to 12 months to get somewhere. And the first kind of group of people that the one out is like the crypto funds. And there are probably 20, 30 like crypto funds out there in the world with proper strategy, institutional background, understanding how to conduct investment activity. And these guys were going to dictate basically how this sector is going to grow because they are the contact for their LPs, and LPs have all the money which they basically take from Goldman and put into them. You know, that's
the mechanism. That's the game.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Talk a little bit more about how the LPs drive decision making.
Absolutely. I mean, so we covered that a little bit in terms of, you know, who are current LPs and what kind of tickets they're writing. But as part of the due diligence for some of our clients, as most of our clients, they basically ask who's your custodian, what is the walled garden framework, how it works. So we end up talking to them. Mm-hmm. And we end up talking with...
As the custody provider.
Yeah, you're basically, it's a new space. They want to make sure that how this works. And
make sure you're real.
Exactly.
You're doing it the right way.
Exactly. And these are very, very sophisticated guys. And it's not a matter of like, you know, whether they want to invest, it's how much they want to invest, because it's a risk return for them. So they weigh the risks by conducting the full due diligence of a cycle, etc. And keep in mind, like, execution venues today are places like, you know, BitMEX, etc. So they also
not exactly the most institutional friendly places.
Exactly, but it's through the reflection of the crypto space today. So at least, you know, we have kind of that's It's basically super efficient, you know, in terms of like where we are, what we're doing, etc. So, you know, going forward, it's either these guys will adjust and make sure that they tick all the boxes for institutional guys to have the flow from them, or someone else will do it. You know, mm-hmm. someone else will, like, you know, here, UK, whatever, wherever, like, you know, we'll sit down, build a derivatives exchange, properly regulate it, and then you know, get the flow. So. But it's good to see like many companies like coming into the space and providing all of these different services, like driving efficiency even forward. So it's I think it's a good thing.
Where do you think we still have to improve, right? Like what are the next kind of steps, and then what's the future of kind of custody, prime brokerage, and other financial infrastructure for the custody, for the crypto industry?
I think it's always like, you know, I've got a technology finance background, and I think where the most stumbling blocks always are, it's when you try to build something straight away for 2035, and like it's like, you know, you build a wheel, like Lamborghini wheel, and like bring it, and there's like a cart outside, you know. So it's like, I think those components should kind of like be stacked with each other in such a manner that we have MVP and we move to MVP 2.0, etc., and then we have alpha, beta, and blah, 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 blah. And we basically go with what works today, what solves the problems today, rather than solving hypothetical problems somewhere down the line in the future. So then, I mean, that's what we're doing. That's what some of the other players are doing in the space. So I think it's when, you know, everyone got excited about like end of 2000 institutions coming next year, like we were that institution. We're like, this is not happening. Mm-hmm. Like we can't. Like
they want, the desire was there, but the infrastructure wasn't.
Yeah, exactly. So we're now seeing first proper institution launches, like from Q1 this year. Mm-hmm. Like that's the bigger ones pulled the plug when. But also, by the way, what was blessing in disguise is when Bitcoin went from 6,000 to 4,000. We saw basically, so our conversation is like 50-50 chance basically that you're going to sit down and have a proper conversation with a potential client, or you would have a conversation of like somebody who's managing like, you know, $20,000, and like the guy bought Bitcoins like in 2010 and now he's a fund manager. So, and for us, like it eliminated all of them basically. So the guys who stayed there, who stayed in the sector, they know exactly what they invest in. They know exactly how they invest in. They know exactly how to communicate the investment strategy.
The tourists went away.
Yeah. Sorry?
The tourists exactly. went away.
Yeah, tourists. Yeah, correct. Yeah, absolutely. And that was absolutely great. Like, so everyone kind of like who went through this. And by the way, no one was kind of like second guessing it. Mm-hmm. Like everyone just like kept doing what they're doing. And they're like, okay, we're like on target to launch that. And then, you know, all the variables aligned. All of the, you know, money are lined up. Let's do it. And then people do it. So it's great to see the first kind of like conductions happening.
For sure. Year. What, before I finish up, I always do rapid fire questions. What do you think is the most important company in crypto?
I think it's not one company. I think it's a consortium. And and I think it's when it comes to spreading the word and the media. I think media in
Oh, interesting. You think the media is the most important?
Absolutely, because without the media, we wouldn't see the responses from, like, regulators wouldn't care, like, some other players wouldn't care, like, some people wouldn't be thinking they're missing the boat, some people wouldn't spend the time. So it's kind of like content, and it's like, you know, you create liquidity, like you're a market maker, and then there's like on the other side, there is a taker, and then you know, people have to react to it.
And it's like the media is basically a liquidity provider of information.
Exactly.
And without, it's a really interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, and liquidity is basically is the key. Liquidity is your oxygen. Mm-hmm. So, and then the space, for example, people would just dismiss it and say, okay, well, no one cares about it. But yeah. When, you know, you have like, you know, Cointelegraph, CoinDesk, Bloomberg, you know, FT, you know, everyone's basically writing about it, you kind of understand, okay, well, it's time to look into it.
Yeah, that's a really good answer. What about regulation? What one regulation would you change or improve if you could?
It depends which kind of like place we're talking about. So everyone's got like all sorts of things. So for example, in this country, I would say Howey, definitely. So
okay, US Howey test.
Yeah, and just generally, you know, judging things by the way they were done. Because it's this market been in existence like the longest, right? So, but judging like the same way as we would be judging like activities like, you know, 50 years ago shouldn't be the case. In the UK and Europe, I would say RDR. So RDR is basically the what you can sell to retail clients.
Okay.
Because retail end up with a subpar product, and which have been basically invest in the market with like effective 5% fees. Mm-hmm. And they don't invest in like complete rubbish, which is good, which is what regulator tried to achieve, but they also can't invest or they can't sell them the product which could be interesting and they're not rubbish. So let's say with specifically, you know, with security tokens and different parts of the infrastructure coming to them, that needs to be adjusted. And Asia, man, I mean, it's Asia. Principal agent trading, never heard of it. It's like, you know, people taking retail clients for a ride, like everywhere, you know. So principal trading is like, you know, market making, and agent trading is basically so in Europe it's illegal, you know, in Asia everything's possible. So yeah, I would say a little bit more maturity in terms of the regulations would be nice there.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. What's your most controversial thought
on
what do you believe that a few people in the crypto community also believe?
Yes, this is something which is from the crypto community. I think it's that the drive of institutional adoption is going to come from finance and not from engineering.
So you're saying that the institutional adoption is going to come because we become smarter and more mature on the finance side, not the engineering side.
Correct. Yeah.
Got
correct.
It.
I think engineering is there. Like we have so much already out there that like we could ever wish for. Like and for finance, it's just a matter of at least adopting parts of that currently. And obviously, in the crypto community, it's predominantly engineers community, and engineering community. It's common belief that, you know, like screw finance. And you know, like you go to different conferences, and it's guys are discussing how do we do this, how do we do that. And the majority of the like 80% of the questions already answered by the regulator. Like they have a playbook for that. Mm-hmm. So yeah,
got it. Makes sense. What's the most important book you've ever read?
I would say Extreme Ownership.
Ah, Jocko Willink.
Yeah, absolutely big fan. Read both books. I'm a big kind of fan, or I have lots of interest in companies, cultures, and how to build companies, culture, and human psychology. Mm-hmm. And I believe with that approach, that's like a life hack for building efficient teams that get results. And I think since the guys were in the military, the cost of a mistake was not like a delayed launch in 6 months. The cost of a mistake was a human life. So how...
Changed the game.
Exactly. Completely different. So we read it, like the whole team read it. We read both books and it helps. It helps big time.
Yeah, I think that's a very unique perspective on the world of just, hey, you're responsible for what happens.
Yeah.
Right? And
yeah.
Take ownership
yeah,
of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Go from there. Aliens, believer, non-believer... Think they're real?
I think in infinite amount of universes, everything's possible, right? So
everything or anything?
yeah, absolutely.
Both, right? Yeah. You think we'll discover alien life before you and I die?
That is also impacting how much we're going to live, right? Like by how long we're going to live.
Good answer.
So I think it's kind of like, you know, it comes from both sides, hard to estimate.
Let's say that we've got average life 75 years. So
probably
your 30s.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So call it another 35, 40 years.
I think we'll discover some form of life, bacteria, and you know, that would be already that is the thing, something. But again, you know, this is like me speculating, zero knowledge about it. So mm-hmm. my opinion on this, you know, I wouldn't value too high.
Spoken like a true risk management.
Yeah, exactly.
What one question do you have for me to finish up?
I think it would be interesting to ask you is when do you think the next financial crisis is going to be? And since last created Bitcoin, what do you think is going to come out of the next one?
Man, everyone is asking me something related to this lately. So next financial crisis, I'll say, I'm going to give a really safe answer of next 5 years. One's going to happen. It's just doesn't go up and right to the right forever. I don't think it's, you know, another 10 years of this type of market. But I also don't think it's like tomorrow, right? So like, is it a year, 3 years? I have no clue. I tend to just say that like, I want to be, I want to hope for the best, but be prepared for the worst type attitude. So that's on the timing. And then how Bitcoin will
What would come out of the next one? So Bitcoin was created during the financial crisis, last financial crisis. What would come out of the next
automation?
One? Automation.
Yeah, I think a lot of these financial crises and just issues in general in the financial system can be solved with software and automation.
Yeah.
And if you look at Bitcoin is like the automation of money, right? The kind of software backed of money. And I think that we'll just see it not just be money this time. I think coming out of the next one, it'll be a much more automated system. And ultimately, it's because when you have automation and more kind of software-based systems, you can just prevent a lot of bad shit from happening, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so...
no humans, no error.
Yeah, depending on just like what the cause of it is. And it's always, you know, hindsight's 20/20. But I do think for Bitcoin specifically... I keep talking about this perfect storm, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of, you know, late first half next year, you're going to probably get some interest rate cuts. You'll probably get some QE. Mm-hmm. You're going to get the Bitcoin halving.
Interesting.
If you're paying attention to U.S. politics, we got a president who's conducting trade wars on Twitter. So you kind of have all these things coming together. That'll be interesting to see how they all interact. And I tend to think they're bullish for Bitcoin.
Yeah.
But again, we've never seen Bitcoin perform in a down market, or, you know, all the kind of traditional stuff. So that's one piece. The second thing is I just see us starting to get serious about automation and software in finance when there's another like kind of sober moment, right? And so it kind of takes you to get hit in the head with a 2x4 to like pay attention.
Yeah.
And I think some sort of recession or you know, financial crisis would do that to us. And then once that happens, I think people will start paying attention and kind of get their act together.
Right. Interesting.
By the way, I could be completely wrong.
No, it makes sense.
So it's just, you know, an idea.
Yeah, you have next year. Next year is going to be definitely, I mean, it's very well described.
If we get interest rate cuts, QE, a move towards modern monetary theory, and the Bitcoin halving all at the same time, I'll see you later, man.
There is one more event.
It's like
actually
rocket fuel.
This year, China has 3 celebrations. And they can't afford the financial crisis this year, but next year it's going to be over. So the market there, I think, is also like
all coming together.
It's all coming together. Yeah.
And look, and I'm always, whenever I talk about this stuff, I'm always very careful to say like I do not want a financial crisis to hit. They're incredibly painful, incredibly bad for people. A lot of people get hurt, right? And so we should do everything we possibly can to avoid this stuff. I just unfortunately think that there's people asleep at the wheel, right?
Yeah.
And no matter how much UI or anybody else yells and screams about this stuff, it's coming down the pipe, right? And so as investors, the job we have, you know, that we're tasked with is to be prepared for this stuff and find ways to make money, regardless if the market's going up or down.
Yeah.
And so all we can do is kind of call out what we see.
Yeah, makes sense.
So, listen, man, I appreciate you doing this. I'm glad that you guys are building kind of professional infrastructure for the space. It is much needed. Obviously, institutions cannot come in and refuse to come in until the stuff's in place. So the work you're doing is incredibly important. And we'll have to do this again in the future so that we can get an update on how things are going.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me again.
For sure.
Are you curious about cryptocurrency and you don't know where to begin? I've got a great way for you to try. You can use StormPlay, a free and fun way to start earning in exchange for your time. That's right, you don't necessarily have to make a financial investment to begin. You can simply download, register, and then discover these micro tasks that they present you that meet your interest, and then you're rewarded with these Storm Bolts. The bolts are then converted and can be withdrawn into your favorite cryptocurrency, including the Storm Token, Ethereum, or my favorite, Bitcoin. If you go and download the StormPlay app today, you can earn cryptocurrency rewards by playing new games and trying out cool new products. It's worth a try, and it's a great way to get started. Remember, go check out StormPlay in the App Store today.
Hey everyone, Pop here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the five blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.